Session number 11614, William Millin, Reel 1.
Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Canada, the city of Regina, Saskatchewan.
How did you come to be born there? Because I thought you were a Scotsman.
Well, my parents were Scottish, and my father served with the Canadian police. And I was born there. My sister was born in Wawota, and my brother in Moose Jaw.
Did you grow up in Canada or in Scotland?
No, I returned to Scotland when I was at a very early age, and I was brought up, educated in Scotland.
Where did you go to school in Scotland?
In Glasgow. I finished up at Uddingston Grammar School on the outskirts of Glasgow.
How old were you when you left school?
I should have left at 16, but I left at 15 and a half because I wanted to enter the army, because the war clouds were looming at that time, and I wanted to join the 7th Battalion of the Highland Light Infantry, that was a Glasgow regiment, as a piper.
So this was in 37 or 38?
Yeah, and I played with the 7th Battalion Highland Light Infantry in 1938 at the Glasgow Exhibition. I was only a young lad then.
How would you come to know the pipes?
Well, my next door neighbour was a piper in the Glasgow Police Pipe Band. And if he hadn't lived next door to me, I'd probably have packed it all up, because it's very difficult learning the bagpipes. But he was next door, so therefore I had to keep practising. He kept me at it, and I was very pleased he did, because when I did go to the regular army at Fort George, the Cameron Highlanders, the bagpipes helped me into the band and helped me to different places, and after that.
Did you have an instructor in the bagpipes?
Well, he was the instructor. This next door neighbour, this piper in the Glasgow Police, a person called Charlie Moyer. Moyer, M-O-I-R.
And how many bagpipers would you get in a Scottish regiment?
Well, in the Scottish regiments at that time, there was the band, and of course the war had started, and the government was short of money, and they couldn't afford to upkeep bands in Highland regiments and other British regiments, for that matter. So they were disbanding bands left, right and centre. So they had one band at the depot, each depot, a full band, whether it was a bagpipe band, a Scottish regiment or a military band, the English or other regiments. Well, in the battalions, when I went to the battalions, they only had five pipers. But they get round this way of disbanding the bands by forming what was called an ACAC group, or Royal Army Medical Corps section. And all the people who were in the ACAC group, that was Lewis guns in the back of trucks to defend the regiment when it was on manoeuvres and things like that. So when it came to the parade, the band would come from the ACAC group or the Royal Army Medical Corps section, and they had the band going. But it wasn't a recognised band. It was, they get round it that way. But it was only five pipers to the battalion, one to each company. But in a big parade, the band used to come forward and parade as a band.
So officially, you were a Bren gunner?
Yeah, a Bren gunner, yes, officially, yes. Until I left the Camerons and went to the Commandos.
When did that come about?
That came about a couple of years later, 18 months later. I volunteered for the Commandos. And of course, being the piper again, Lord Lovett picked me up then as his personal piper. He was a famous commando leader at that time, with a reward of about £30,000 in his head. Hitler had put this on because of commando actions from Lofoten to Dieppe and different places. So he wanted me to be his personal piper. He had formed a new brigade.
What made you want to change to the commandos?
Well, things weren't exciting enough at that time, and I wanted some more excitement. So I ended up at Achnacarry, a place called Achnacarry in the Highlands. It was a commando training centre, and the colonel in charge of that place was a Colonel Charlie Vaughan, a Cockney with a very strong Cockney accent, ex-regular soldier who had come up from the ranks to colonel, but had a great way of dealing with people and very modern ideas for that time. Having served in the 1418 war and the trench warfare and all that, he was had pushed all that out of his mind and was more of active movement rather than warfare and trenches. It was more for getting about, and which the war was all about later. So the commanders were looked on by Colonel Vaughan, and he gathered around him people who were dissatisfied in regiments, people who had great ideas but weren't allowed to express their ideas or put them into operation. So he took these people, officers and other ranks, sergeants, right down to private soldiers, into the commandos and formed a group of instructors who could put these ideas into movement, fire and movement, all that kind of stuff. No static warfare, that was a thing of the past. It was all action and moving quickly and attacking and coming away again. And that's where I ended up on the demonstration, in the demonstration troop at Achnacarry, the Commander Training Centre.
As an instructor?
An instructor.
Do you remember the dates that you volunteered for the commandos?
I can't. Well, I was there, let's see, about 1941 to 45. Roughly. I can't remember the exact month because we were coming and going at that time.
Did you ever regret having volunteered for them?
No, as I said in my book, I enjoyed every minute of it. Because when you're a young man, I was about 18 and a half at that time. Well, the average age of commandos was from 18 to 25. If you were over 25, you were over the hill. In fact, remember during the invasion of Normandy, I was 20. Lovett was 32. Well, we regarded him as an old man. So the average age was 18 to 25. You were, that was nothing over that.
Coming back to the pipes for a minute, what kind of tunes would you typically play on the pipes in either a Scottish regiment or in the commandos?
Well, in the commandos, when Lovett asked me to be his piper to lead the invasion of Europe, well, Lord Lovett, he is the chief of the Clan Fraser, so he's a Scotsman for a start. If he hadn't been a Scotsman, well, I don't suppose I would never have been heard about. So him being a Scotsman and chief of the Clan Fraser, he wanted, and as a brigadier of the 1st Commando Brigade, a new brigade he had formed for the invasion, if he hadn't been a Scotsman, I wouldn't have been the piper. But anyway, his favourite tune was Highland Laddie. That was the regimental march past of the Scots Guards. That was his parent regiment where he was trained. So that was his favourite tune, Highland Laddie. And Blue Bonnets Over the Border.
But what about your own favourite?
Well, I never had any special tune. I just played, when I played anywhere, what would you like me to play? And if I knew it. Most times I knew it anyway, because most people ask for the most popular tunes. But Lovett, being a piper himself, I had to be that extra bit better playing, because he knew if I was making mistakes or anything. But when he asked me to go with him, he said, you will be the only piper to land with the assault troops. The commando brigade has the honour of landing first, and that you'll be the only piper to land in Normandy playing bagpipes.
Why do Scottish regiments have pipers?
Well, I suppose it's tradition like any other regiment in the British Army. The other regiments, the Welsh, the Irish, English regiments have their buglers or whatever. And pipes have always been associated with Scottish regiments right from hundreds of years ago, where the bagpipe is a different instrument completely. It can be a warlike instrument. It can be an instrument for dancing, it could be an instrument for marching, and it can be an instrument for funerals, playing laments. So it is a quite a versatile instrument. The most I found that the people who liked me playing for them were, it was not only Scotsmen, but all nationalities, Scots, English, Irish, Welsh, and all French, in the commando brigade with two troops, say about 100 men of French commandos. And they were my greatest supporters of the bagpipes. Even today, they invite me over there. Ah, Bill, you must play the bagpipe, or the cornemuse, as they call it.
But in battle, presumably, the idea was that people would fight better if they heard the pipes.
Well, in this instance, invasion of Normandy, it had been worked out that Major Howard would land about 12, 15 in the morning, capture the bridge, and we would land about 7:30 that same morning, and the beach is about 7 or 8 miles away. Then we would attack and capture the town of Ouistreham on the coast. Then after capturing that town, we would move inland to link up with Major Howard at the bridges, because if he hadn't captured the bridge at Pegasus, Beneville Bridge, as it was known at that time, and the other one, Ranville Bridge, we'd have had to have swam across, because our main objective to attack was the village of Amperville on the hill, the other side of the Orne. Well, luckily enough for us, Major Howard had captured the bridges. So the bagpipes was a signal when the paratroopers would hear the bagpipes. They would know that Lovett's commanders were close at hand.
Going back to Achnacarry, where you were doing the instructor's job, what were your main problems there?
The weather. We used to have all kinds of people. It rained all the time. It was cold, even in the summertime. It rained and it rained and it rained. And we used to have, later on, we were trained American Rangers and the French, Dutch, Poles, Belgians, all kinds of nationalities. And it ended up as the finest infantry training school in the world, which is the training program is still going on today at Linston of the Commando Training Centre. So the weather was the biggest problem. But after a while, once being on the staff there, I get used to it. I didn't bother about the weather then.
What rank did you have there, sergeant?
I was a member of a demonstration troop. We would demonstrate to the officer intake or the ordinary soldier intake, later the Royal Marine intake and the French intake, all the intakes that come in. We would demonstrate what we would say, an opposed landing. We'd go around the lock, we would get down there and get into a mock-up landing craft, and they would double down, take up position. We would give and say, we'd dash ashore and the Bren gun, they would take up position there. Trench mortar, the sniper, and would attack a position. They're training people what to do during an attack, how to attack a position, and handling of weapons, British, American, Allied weapons, and German and Japanese weapons. Teach them how to operate these mortars and automatic weapons.
Presumably, whilst you were doing this instructor's work, you weren't doing any piping.
Yeah, doing piping all the time, because we formed a little group amongst ourselves in the demonstration troop, and we played bagpipes. Well, they were all English. I think I was only Scotsman then. But the terrific enthusiasm for playing the bagpipes. With nothing else to do, we were stuck up in the hills. And so bagpipes was something you could really get down to if you had no other interruptions that we didn't have in the evening. This is the rain coming down and wet clothes all over the place, and so we're still piping.
Were you called to go on any operations before D-Day?
No, I was on the staff. We were training people to go on the operations.
Do you remember any accidents in the training?
Well, you're allowed some percentage of casualty, because it was all live ammunition that was used. There's no blanks, and so therefore, so when the American Rangers came up first, they come from Hawaii. Well, of course, a different temperature there, and I met them at the railway station at Speen Bridge, about 7.5 miles away, near this village, and the rain was coming down, freezing, cold rain in February, and they were to march the 7.5 miles back to Achnacarry, and I think completely the weather. They were demoralised before their training even started. And, of course, this caused a bit of a problem at first suppose they were smoking and they liked their cans of beer, which smoking and cans of beer was definitely out if you were running up and down hills. So, but the sale, well, for them, they knuckled down and they ended up quite good. And they did their 7.5 mile speed marches, or 15 mile speed marches, their pose landings and their 36 mile treks. But not trying to downgrade them a bit, but I always thought that the British soldiers were the ideal type for commando work. They were a different temperament from the Americans or any other nationality. They could stick it out better, I thought, in action. You could see how the British soldiers have got this reputation over the years. They grumble and moan and groan, but they can stick it out no matter what the weather or what the conditions. And I think the training, even the Americans, after the American Rangers we had trained had landed in southern Italy, and the commanding officer sent word to Colonel Vaughan. They said that the training at Achnacarry had adapted them very well to the landings at Anzio.
What do you remember about the preparations for D-Day as they involved you?
Oh, just hard training. I left Achnacarry and joined Lovett's 1st Commando Brigade at Sussex. I think it was, Lord Cowdrey's estate. We were billeted there, and Lord Cowdrey, he had lost an arm at Dunkirk, and he puts grounds out to the commanders. They used to pipe in his house, and love it to dinners and one thing and another. Then we left there. We went to another place and won civvy billets with families. This is one good thing about commanders, who were always billeted with families. Then from Sussex, we went to Southampton. Southampton Common. I don't know if you... Do you know the Common, Southampton?
Yes.
We were there for about 5 weeks waiting in the weather changing for the invasion. And during this time, the thousands of troops in, on the Common at that time, Americans, all kinds of people. And each day I used to take the commanders out in route marches, playing the bagpipes. Go out in the morning with the Marines, and then in the afternoon with the French, and then out with the number 4 commander, 3 commander, or 6 commander, up around the waterworks. And we were all fit as fiddlers, and I could marching for hours now. We didn't count the miles, it was hours and hours. So we left Southampton Common and then went to the Humber River, the Humber, and the Rising Sun. That was a pub there. Along the river bank, that was Lovett's headquarters. In fact, a few years ago, I went down, and my wife and I went down, and I played the pipes at the unveiling of a plaque to the commanders. This is where the headquarters of the commanders rises on, and the commandos sailed from the Humber River for the invasion of France. So we got there, and there was a flotilla of 21 small landing craft, assault craft, because I was in the leading craft with Lovett and the flotilla commander. A lovely evening, we sailed down the river and approaching the Isle of Wight on the right, and thousands of ships, all sizes, in a lovely summer's evening. And Lovett had me up in the front of the landing craft, playing the pipes, piping the flotilla down. And as we drew level with the Isle of Wight and all these ships, the terrific roar went up because they had put me over the loud hailer system, and the people throwing their admirals and all kinds of people throwing their hats in the air. Well, we were the first to set out because we were going to be the first to hit the beaches, as they say, those assault troops. Then after passing the Isle of Wight, the sea started to get choppy, so it was too... The ramps were down and everything. It was kind of dangerous standing in the front of the landing craft. So they went underneath then. So that was about 9 o'clock in the evening.
How were you dressed?
Like that, the kilt on and battle dress blouse and rucksack, you know, that Bergen rucksacks. I didn't carry any weapon. Later, I was trained in all the weapons, of course. Being a demonstration troop, I could use any of the weapons because we trained the intake coming in that I can carry. But that was my dress for the landings in Normandy. Of course, it went down stairs in the boat to the hold. We were all lying sick. I was sick the whole way across. About 5 o'clock in the morning, I come up on deck and the wind whistling around, and the Allied battleships had opened a barrage on the beaches, and the shells were all rushing across, and I could see in the mist and the beach and the shellers, and then the Germans shooting back the thing like that, the spouts of water going up. And I let the others, of course, would do anything to get off the boat. Didn't care who was on shore, no matter what it was like. No thoughts of getting killed or wounded or anything, just to get off that boat and get away from that terrible seasickness feeling. So when the craft drew in close and we ran aground, the ramps went down and then we'll get off, and then the cold water bring you around a bit, and then that was the start of it.
What kind of a kilt did you have on?
No, it was a Cameron kilt. I don't know, it's not got the painting, it's just got kind of red tartan there.
Why a Cameron tartan?
Well, because I was always associated with the Camerons. I'd been in the Camerons. My father had served in the Camerons in the 1418 War. In fact, I still got his kilt upstairs. And my mother's two brothers had served in the Camerons. So it was natural that I would have a Cameron kilt.
And you all wore the Green Beret?
Wore the Green Beret. We didn't wear steel helmets in action. This would cause a bit of a problem when we went up to London to unveil the Overlord embroidery. It depicts me playing the pipes. They had me with a steel helmet on. Of course, there was Lovett and the Queen Mother, Lord Mountbatten, and Lord Dalverton, you know, Whitbread's Brewery people, and all these famous people were all there. And walking around, and Lovett got his eye, this picture of me, that these women from the Royal School of Needlework had did the embroidery. He pushed, "Oh, commandos never wore steel helmets." Anyway, within the week, the ladies were a bit upset at the time. Within the week, they had taken the stitches out of the steel helmet and replaced it with a beret, with Lovett's and Lovett's tartan on the bag, the bagpipes that you can see in the museum at Portsmouth.
This is the Lovett Fraser tartan.
Lovett Fraser tartan, yeah. But we had always been Camerons. My family had always been in the Cameron regiments. And that is my father and my mother's two brothers. So we were all connected with the Camerons. So naturally that I would wear the... Lovett didn't like it at times because of being of a different regiment. But anyway, he had served in the Scots Guards, so that was a different tartan from his own Fraser tartan, so it didn't make any difference. I said that to him. I said, "Well, it shouldn't make any difference. You served in the Scots Guards. That was a different tartan from yours. So I served in the Camerons. Now I'm with you, so I can wear your tartan and the Camerons. So now I've made a compromise. I wear only the Hunting Stuart. They're all family tartan, so I'm completely neutral now. So I can go and play for him or the Camerons or anywhere now, and people will say, 'What tartan is that?' I say, 'Well, it's a Royal Family's tartan.' So no one argues then.
Can you describe to me what happened to you on landing?
Well, the words before we left England to the lectures and pep talks that Lovett used to give and all that people used to give, the beach will be under heavy fire when, as soon as you get foot on the sand, get off the beach because it'll be under heavy shell fire. So when we landed, it was under heavy fire. And lots of people were being killed. I know I dashed up after I jumped off the water, as it said, see that picture. And I started to play the pipes, and Lovett looked round and he heard the pipes and smiled, and then I walked on. So I piped when the water was a bit here, waist high, right up onto the beach. Then I stopped. Then I dashed off where I seen an exit, and here I got to the exit. There was a load of wounded all lying about. And of course, they'd seen me with the tartan, you see. And they said, "Where's the medics?" They'd been shot. They'd probably try to go up this road and posted by a German machine gunner at the top. I'd chopped them all down. There'd be about 12 or maybe 14 of them, all lying in the sand at the entrance to this road. And they said, "Where's the medics, Jock? Where's the medics?" I said, "Well, they're coming." I didn't know whether they were coming or not, but I just said they're coming. So just at that, a burst of machine fire had come down there. I went into looking a doorway about this depth, so I stood inside the doorway. And they were all lying in front of me. I tried to pull one or two of them away, back out of the fire line from the coming down the road. But they were still shooting, so I just had to get to the side into the doorway. Then I looked around ahead, and I heard a clanking. Now and I looked around, and there was one of these flail tanks with the chains, stairs up the mines. That was coming up from the beach, heading for the road, and just the top of the commander's head looking out with a steel helmet. And they're coming towards the road, and I was going like this. And anyway,
gesticulating to him.
The wounded were all lying in this path. But anyway, obviously it wasn't the road that was talking about to here, to the right. And I seen he was making for the road, which was too narrow for the tank, really. And I nicked out of there and got out of the way, and of course it came up, and chains going, and churned them all up. And then last I seen of him, the tank was going up the road, taking the walls away at the side, and then I dashed back, and that's when I came up to Lord Lovett. And he was, when I was talking to him, the brigade major chap, Dunnett White or something like that. That was his nickname. His name was White, but they called Dunnett White. In the army, everybody paints everything white, whether it's coal or anything. His name was White, so they called him Dunnett White because they always seen paint these things white. And he came over and he said to Lovett, "Good news, sir, the Paris have captured the bridges at the Orne." Then Lovett looked round and seen me standing down there. I said, "Oh, give us a tune." Well, the whole idea was ridiculous because people with shellfire and all kinds of things going on at the time. And it was mad enough, three of us standing there. We shouldn't have been really standing. We should have been lying down, really. But the whole thing was ridiculous. They said, give us a tune, Piper. And I said, "Well, it may as well be ridiculous as well." I said, "What tune would you like, sir?" He said, "Well, play the Road to the Isles." I said, "Would you like me to march up and down?" "Yes, yes, march up and down. That'd be lovely." So the whole thing was ridiculous. Even the bodies lying in the water were going back and forward, you know, with the tide, you know, the water was wafting in. They were moving back and forth. And I started off and piping, going about a few paces along there. And next thing, a hand on my shoulder. And this voice, I looked around, it was a sergeant I recognised. He says, "What are you fucking playing at, you mad bastard?" He's attracting all the German attention, all every fucking German in France knows we're here now, you silly bastard. But anyway, I walked away and I looked around, and of course there's other people up at the wall there. They're going like this.
Cheering.
They're cheering, yeah. But anyway, up and down a couple of times, and then this time I came down, I turned around, they'd all gone. I said, "Didn't they say that was fast?" Never even told me. But anyway, I seen some disappearing away in the distance, so I caught after them, and they were going across country at this time. So that was action on the beach.
How frightening was it all?
Well, the people say frightening, but at that time, it was too busy to be. It might sound odd, but it was good. And the frightening part hadn't started because it was all everything was happening so quickly, so sudden. The noise and the action, the people, some wounded, some dead, and the heads blown off, and that lot were churned up with the tank. And I think everything had happened. I couldn't say I was actually frightened. I don't think I was frightened at all. Actually, I don't think anyone at that particular time. I think the fear was later on. Once we're in a few hours ashore.
How long do you think you were on the beach?
Not very long, because it wasn't very healthy. Even this day, I don't know why we were so long. It could only have been a few minutes, really. It didn't mean very long, because the idea was to get ashore and get off the beach. But I think the shellfire, German shellfire, had just forced us to try and dig in on the beach for a while. But they didn't want that. They wanted to get off no matter what, and the casualties were, we would get worse if we stayed in the beach. The casualties probably been worse. Because it's usually the people, it's not the assault troops that gets them the severe casualties, it's the people coming behind. Because you've landed suddenly, and once they recover and they know it's an attack, then the enemy start to bring the pressure to bear on the beach. So we had to get off quickly because we had a long way to go to link up with the Paras, cross the river, the canal, the Orne Canal, then cross the river, Orne, then attack the village on the hill.
How long did it take you to get from the beach to the Pegasus Bridge?
Well, it took, we should have been there about 12, I suppose. We landed, say, about 7:30, 7:15 in the morning, but we had to first attack the town, the coastal town of Wistram, which you know, if you visit there, is a fairly large town. But luckily for us, two French troops were with about 100 men there, plus number 4 commander, part 6 commander. And the local French, knowing the lingo, showed the commanders where the strong points were. Like the strongest point was a casino. So the commander attacked that first, and captured the casino. And of course, the rest of